Good morning. We welcome you all for a hearing on two matters, and we'll deal with the first matter first. 0711, in the matter of the petition to create a rule governing the discretionary transfer of cases to tribal courts. I have as the presenter, the Honorable James Moore, and I have other appearances, the Honorable Eugene Whitefish, the Honorable John Anderson, the Honorable Gary Sherman, and Attorney Harkis. Are there any other appearances? If anyone is moved to appear later, would you advise the marshal? All right. Judge Moore.
Good morning. As chair and on behalf of the State Tribal Justice Forum Committee, we are here to ask you to approve Petition 7-11, creating a discretionary mechanism to transfer civil cases to tribal court. I know my committee initially would like to publicly acknowledge the continued interest and foresight by this court in continuing to promote and foster cooperative state-tribal relationships. This court, in essence, created our committee and many of our members. I would like to, as well, initially introduce to you the current membership of our committee. Our committee consists of five state court judges, Judge Habeck from Shawano County, Judge Lobbs from Jackson County is here, Judge Nielsen from Vilas County is here, Michael Gableman from Burnett County, John Anderson from Bayfield County is here. Our committee consists of five tribal judges as well. They are Richard Ackley from Bad River. I know Richard is here. Kimberly Beely from Stockbridge-Muncie. Robert Miller, also from Stockbridge-Muncie. Chris McGeeshick from Mole Lake and Leland Ninham from Oneida. Jerry Lang, District Court Administrator, 4th District, is our member as well. James Botsford, Wisconsin Judicare, is our member from the Indian Law Section of the State Bar. And Gary Sherman is our representative from the Legislative Council. John Velker is an ad hoc member who is at most of our meetings and has played an active role. And last but not least, I do want to acknowledge Aaron Slattengren from the Director's Office. I can tell you without staff, our committee would certainly be floundering. We appreciate that as well. The general charge of our committee is to promote and sustain communication, education, and cooperation among tribal and state court systems, and to work to promote initiatives outlined in the final report of the Walking on Common Ground Conference. This petition has some history to it. Since this court in the Teague decision noted in a footnote that our committee would be an appropriate group to look at allocation of jurisdiction between state and tribal courts, we have been doing that for a number of years, and a discretionary transfer mechanism has been one of the issues on our front burner, and this petition is our final product. You should as well be aware that this petition is in addition to the protocols that currently exist in Districts 9 and 10. The reason we believe this petition is needed in this state is that currently for 25 counties in the north in Districts 9 and 10, they operate under an allocation protocol, the Teague protocols. The rest of the state, in dealing with the issue of allocation of jurisdiction, generally needs and works under your pronouncements in the Teague case. There are no other standards out there that helps judges use their discretion as to determining the appropriate placement of any given case. As we traveled around the state, we have heard expressed from a number of judges the need for supportive guidance in working through state, tribal, jurisdictional questions of comity, courtesy, and communication. This discretionary rule, we believe, provides that standard to those judges. Judges will be in a much better position to use their discretion in making decisions concerning where cases should be heard. As Chief Abrahamson noted in the Teague case, comity is highly discretionary and fact-specific. This rule, we believe, should help this discretionary call. Another benefit of this rule, we believe, is that it will foster a faster and more efficient mechanism for case management. And let me explain. If you recall in the 60s and 70s when the federal government noted that supporting our children ought to be a priority, and during that period of time a lot of money funneled to the states to establish child support agencies, prosecutors to enforce child support orders. During that time, at least here in Wisconsin, we did not have tribal courts that were actively engaged in either determining paternity or establishing child support. As a result, the counties did all of that work. Well, that has now changed in great part. The federal government is assisting tribes now in establishing child support agencies. And for example, the Potawatomi have a child support agency, and Judge Whitefish just indicated to me that I believe it was last year they collected over $2 million for their children. But during this period of time, all of these orders ended up in state circuit courts. And for instance, I'm beginning to see a lot of work in this area. I had a tribal member just recently stop in asking how she could get the case in tribal court. And she had just broken up a tribal child enrolled member. They were both enrolled members living on the reservation. The paternity judgment was in Sawyer County, and the husband, not the husband, the dad, filed a motion to modify in Sawyer County, and she wanted the matter heard in tribal court. Because we operate under the Teague protocol, what we had to indicate to her is that protocol is a protocol that deals with conflict. You need to have cases filed in both jurisdictions before it kicks in. So I had to explain to her that she actually had to file all our paperwork. She had to pay us another $50 to start an action in LCO tribal court, at which time we could then stay the action and then have judges discuss where the case should be. Knowing, as I do, that in Sawyer County, I was quite aware of the fact that I think if she could just have asked the judge to have the case transferred, he would have looked at the facts and would have transferred the case. And so that's a good example of a type of case I'm seeing quite a bit, which I think this petition would help. Our hope is that we will have forms developed that will allow litigants, because so much is pro se, simply fill out, take to the state court judge, and ask the judge to transfer the case.
You see, and most, as I indicated, Judge Moore,
yes.
You see most of these cases in family law, would you guess?
Okay. The ones I'm beginning to see, almost all of them. And one of the problems with the Teague and the controversy is it takes such a long time to get that process going. In a lot of these family cases, you need to really deal with the situation as rapidly as possible, and that's what we hope we can do by having this rule and forms and the ability to move cases back where.
And this is all discretionary with the circuit court judge.
Yes.
Not required.
No, they are not required. It is discretionary. And the other aspect about this rule is if a litigant takes that document requesting transfer and the state court judge makes a record and says no, that person still has the option of filing in tribal court, which would then kick in the Teague protocol, at least for the 25 counties up there.
What about, great. I noticed in the petition that there isn't anything about the views of the parties, and though when you're in litigation, it seems they often have opposite views. What if one person wants it transferred to tribal court and the other person does not? Does the judge then have to hold a hearing so both of their wishes are known, or does the person who doesn't want the transfer have no say in it?
Well, we would assume and hope that it requires notice and a hearing, and that the judge would be able to hear from the litigants and make a discretionary call. Again, this petition does nothing to interfere with the issue of jurisdiction, whether there's exclusive or concurrent or whatever the jurisdiction, that's a separate issue. We're assuming here, obviously, that we are dealing with concurrent jurisdiction situations, and what we are doing is we're leaving it up to the discretion
of... But there still may be a preference that differs for the parties, and I guess I was wondering how you saw that being handled if a petition were filed under this rule.
Sub 2A, as I read it, says the court may on its own motion or the motion of a party and after notice and hearing cause the transfer.
Yes, it would be like any other hearing. You're probably going to have different views, but we believe a judge is in the best position to use his discretion to make determinations as to what court ought to be hearing these cases. And as the Chief noted in Teague, it is very fact-specific. It's hard to say and cubbyhole any specific case because I think most cases are going to differ on their facts. And, of course, we're going to deal with a lot of issues having to do with jurisdiction.
I have another question. I noticed that, and I apologize to you because I had intended to pull out Teague and reread it, but I forgot. You've got 9 factors on page 8 relating to the factors for the discretionary issue. As I remember, Teague had more.
13.
Well, what happened to the other 4? I mean, I don't have a proprietary interest. I'm not committed and wedded to 13 versus 9. And I'm assuming, and as I said, I apologize to you, I had intended to pull Teague and reread it. So
my recollection is we attempted in this rule to have all of those standards included. And as you will note, we had number 9, such other factors as may be appropriate in a particular case to try to catch all of any fact situation that is likely to come up in any given case. So we attempted to be as broad as we could to give as much discretion, but at least some standards as well.
I have another question. This, of course, and I don't have any objection to it, covers the circuit court because that's the court that this court has jurisdiction over for purposes of rulemaking. If the case was started in tribal court and a party wanted to move it into circuit court, you'd have to still then rely on the Teague conflict issue.
Our committee talked about that specific issue, and in fact, there were thoughts and discussions once a decision is made about this petition talking within the tribes to see whether or not it would not make sense for the tribes to have some kind of similar ability of the tribal judge to transfer cases. Our hope is to foster this relationship, and that's one of the aspects of this rule. I think it will, in part, require that cooperative effort to make the right decision. And as everyone understands that we are in this together, that we are doing the people's business, and I think it's as best as we can hope to try to keep doors open and let litigants file their cases, but have, you know, a court system be in a position to have a flexible ability to move cases.
Once the court, the circuit court moves that case, and under this, the tribal court has to accept it. If it doesn't accept it,
yes,
it's finished. The circuit court has lost jurisdiction, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And the tribal court judgment will become the judgment in that case.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And we put in a 60-day time limit for transfer of the case. If the tribal court does not accept jurisdiction, it would remain with the state court.
Judge Moore, I've got a question. I noticed when you started out, you talked about the fact that in addition to the protocols, there was this proposal. And I'm wondering if there's going to be any effort to continue to encourage other parts of the state to adopt protocols. Because it's obvious to me that this is needed, but in addition, those protocols appear to be needed where there's a real conflict.
Our committee has discussed that as well, and in fact, the chief judge from a district in the south asked that same question. And again, when we talk about protocols, what that means is you have to get all the tribes together. And so there's quite a mechanism when you think about what it would take to do that and how to do that. And, you know, we continue to discuss that situation. Right now, as you indicated, Teague would have to deal with that situation, and those principles of comity and allocation would have to take precedent. But we continue to talk about having some mechanism, hopefully, to address that.
In the protocols that now exist in the 9th and 10th districts, is there a provision for the transfer of the cases from tribal court to circuit court? I assume that there is.
You know, I don't know if I have a definitive answer to that question, and I don't know if it has been raised. I assume that the Teague protocols talked about cases that were filed in state or tribal court, and then the mechanism, and of course within that mechanism decisions can be made whether it will remain in tribal court or whether it will go to state court. But there isn't any discretionary type provision because it requires that litigation.
And this consultation, if I remember it, between the two judges. And if they can't agree, there's a technique for
there's
getting
a, pool
a third of party. Okay.
Within the team framework.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I'm following up on the chief's question, because as I was preparing for this, I thought the same thought came to me. We have jurisdiction, of course, over the state courts, and as number six, of the items set forth in the petition indicate the transfer from circuit court to tribal court. And I said to myself, oh, how about from tribal court to circuit court? And that doesn't exist outside of the protocol districts. And it may or may not, from what I gather, I guess I assumed that it existed in the transfer without the conflict, without the necessary ingredient?
Because we can't speak for the individual tribes unless we have some agreement that reaches the 11 tribes, we do not have any provision here for tribal court transfer, although I assume that it could happen and there would be nothing that would prohibit that, and we would encourage that. When we initially talked about this proposal was going to be a joint proposal going both ways, and it started out with language both ways, and then we thought, well, if we're coming to the Supreme Court here, we can't tell the tribal courts or tribal governments what to do. We can only talk about what state judges do. And so what we've done is we've bifurcated that aspect. We're still working on that, and we're working with the tribes, looking at ways of perhaps promoting that kind of cross-transfer in a discretionary manner.
Yeah, but maybe there ought to be a provision here that says, should a tribal court have a filing, and should a tribal court want to transfer jurisdiction to the circuit court has discretion. If the circuit court has jurisdiction over the matter, otherwise has jurisdiction on that, to accept it, so that if the tribes individually should do this, then we're set for it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, sure. That could be a possibility. I'm assuming if we're talking about a concurrent jurisdiction case,
right.
That it would be acknowledged that the state court has jurisdiction and the tribal court has jurisdiction. And I would assume legally the state court judge could make that decision that this case has jurisdiction in state court such that we could hear it, and understand from tribal court that they have opted out not to accept a jurisdiction.
Yeah, because what you have, I think, at least under certain provisions of the Indian Child Act, that the circuit court has to advise the tribal court and say, do you want jurisdiction here? And if they say yes, I guess it's a transfer. But we've had cases where tribal court has said, no, you circuit court, keep it. And then the circuit court does keep it. So it could be a kind of discretionary matter of taking it.
Yes.
And that would avoid having to come back should the tribes provide for that.
Sure. And that's why we have this provision that if the tribe does not want the case, they can opt out and the state court retains jurisdiction over it.
Good.
Because you should know that really prior to Teague, there is not a lot of case law here in the state of Wisconsin talking about concurrent jurisdiction. Prior to Teague, we were in the mode of exclusive jurisdiction. Who had jurisdiction, state court or tribal court? Since Teague, we have moved to this arena out of conflict, trying to perhaps reach some kind of understanding of good communication, cooperation, and comedy here between state courts and tribal courts so that we can more effectively and efficiently make decisions as to where courts best ought to, I mean, where cases best ought to be heard. And so that's been our movement. But there are still cases out there, for instance, that talk about exclusive jurisdiction. And I think we might best be served as well with several cases making their way up to this court again to help clarify that issue of concurrent jurisdiction, because prior to Teague, there wasn't a lot of talk about that, and we haven't had a lot since, but we continue to operate as we work together in a committee to try to foster cooperative relationship here and just do the people's business and resolve people's problems as best we can by leaving our courthouse doors open to litigants and letting them choose and then letting hopefully our systems, you know, make some plans as to how we wish to move cases back and forth.
Thank you, Judge Moore. Oh, I'm sorry, Justice Presser.
Judge Moore. Have you seen the markup by a member of the Legislative Reference Bureau, Bob Nelson?
Markup of
this draft.
We send the draft to the Legislative Reference Bureau so that the rules follow the format of the statutes so that it makes for easier reading and easier interpretation. And that's what the reference is. And I don't know if that markup is in the folder, but we can give it to you. But go ahead, Justice Brasser.
Is there a date on that, or can you give me some time frame when we're talking?
It's dated September 19th.
Can't say as I've seen it.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that's in the file. We don't think it is in the file. Okay.
Robert Nelson of the Legislative Reference Bureau recommends completely eliminating subsection 1, the statement of purpose. What's your reaction to that?
It would eliminate your purpose statement to effectively and efficiently allocate judicial resources. Situations with the Circuit Court of concurrent jurisdiction, this authorizes the discretion to transfer. The Legislative Reference Bureau doesn't like public policy sections and eliminates it in legislative enactments and follow the same policy here. I personally will object to that markup, but I don't know how the court will feel. That's your point, isn't it, Justice Brasser? Yes.
Yeah, I was asking Judge Moore.
Yeah, I personally do not have a preference one way or the other than specifically noting in there that we need to be careful that we're talking about concurrent jurisdiction and not exclusive jurisdiction. It doesn't specifically add a lot concerning standards or what needs to be done in making determinations of allocation. But I am not attuned to rulemaking or statutes as to what ought to be in there or not, but as far as I'm concerned, it could be in there, or it wouldn't hurt the proposal in my mind if it was removed either. So,
now, what is the intent of the draft with respect to the eligible tribal courts to which a circuit court could refer a case?
Could you clarify that?
Are there 11 tribal courts, or are there all tribal courts in the United States?
Well, I assume if you're talking about should some matter come to a state court judge in another state?
No. I'm saying can a circuit court, hypothetically, could a circuit court refer a case where there was arguably concurrent jurisdiction to the Apache tribe?
Right. Well, there are rules, as indicated under the In-Child Welfare Act, that prescribes what would happen and what should follow. Here, I assume the issue, again, would be a discretionary call of the judge as to what he's going to do with that case. If that case is before that court, he needs to do something with it. I assume there's another litigant in there requesting to transfer this case to another jurisdiction. He would have to make that call as to whether or not, one, he believed it was concurrent jurisdiction case, the state had jurisdiction or whether someone else had jurisdiction.
Under the draft, a litigant wouldn't even have to request a transfer. This could be done in the court's own motion. Isn't that true?
It could, upon notice.
Okay.
And hearing.
The concept of concurrent jurisdiction, where is that really defined? How do we know when we have concurrent jurisdiction?
Well, I think it stems back to Supreme Court decisions that talked about jurisdiction. And here in Wisconsin, what happened as a result of the passage of Public Law 280? And Public Law 280 transferred what jurisdiction the federal government had to the state of Wisconsin. So the issue is, what did they transfer, or what they could they transfer? And the thinking is they could only transfer that jurisdiction that they had, and that tribes always retain their sovereignty and their jurisdiction. And that's why, for instance, in traffic regulation matters, the court said, look, if the legislature wanted to transfer regulatory matters, they could have said so. But because they did not say so, it didn't get transferred. Therefore, that's why the tribes have exclusive jurisdiction when it comes to regulatory matters, traffic that occurs on the reservation. They have exclusive jurisdiction. The concurrent jurisdiction stems from the fact that the federal government could not transfer anything other than that which they could, and that the tribes retain this concurrence in jurisdiction. And I think that's essentially where that comes from. And it specifically,
I think what Justice Prosser is asking is, give us some factors whereby the tribe has jurisdiction. For example, does the matter always have to arise on tribal land before there's jurisdiction? Or does it always have to involve at least one tribal member? Or what are the criteria by which the tribe has jurisdiction over a matter that the circuit courts may also have jurisdiction over?
Jurisdiction, in great part, is determined by the tribe itself. And when its code and pronouncements provide for jurisdiction, they usually tell you what they believe their jurisdiction is. It's interesting to note, for instance, I think it was the Potawatomi code for paternity actions. You know, as far as what they believe they have jurisdiction to non-tribal members or non-Indian, if conception occurs on the reservation, and they have a whole list of jurisdictional requirements, and most tribes and most courts operate under that jurisdiction. So one would have to look at what that jurisdiction is. And the way you get at that is the litigants always have the ability to tell the court, we don't believe you have jurisdiction. Or, you know, we think you do have jurisdiction. I mean, that issue of jurisdiction is really outside this petition. That is something that has to be judged by whatever court is that it is in. As I was indicating to you, there's a case, St. Germain versus Chapman, which is a domestic abuse restraining order, Court of Appeals, in which I know because I was the judge, the Court of Appeals essentially rejected a concurrent jurisdiction argument and held that the tribe had exclusive jurisdiction. Now, that case is still out there, even though we're dealing with, you know, Teague and what we're doing on a concurrent basis. But this whole area of jurisdiction can be very complicated and somewhat confusing, and you have to be very fact-specific, and you have to be able to look at all of the criteria in order to try to get a handle on some of these cases. And you're right that this is going to require, I think, state court judges in part to understand what the tribal jurisdiction is.
That's right.
Because I foresee situations where they may transfer a case, but if somebody brings it up to the tribal court, says you don't have jurisdiction, the tribal court judge could say, you're absolutely right, this is not a case we have jurisdiction, and send it back to the state court judge. I mean, that's a possibility, but that's an issue separate from the petition. This petition assumes that the court that is hearing the matter does have that jurisdiction.
But in order for the petition to operate as you envision it, the judges do have to know about the various jurisdictional provisions of the tribes, and from what little I understand about it, they can vary depending on what the issue happens to be, not solely just on the basis of the tribal authority over their sovereign lands, correct?
Certainly.
So that's why there would be this motion, the opportunity to be heard, for someone to outline in a paternity case the criteria are, you know, these 10 criteria, but in a civil case it might be 6, in a different kind of case it might be 3. You don't know. So it's going to be very case specific and context of the lawsuit specific.
I'm going to assume if a case is in state court and the other litigant files with the judge a request to transfer to tribal court, and the other litigant, for instance, jumps up and says, the tribal court doesn't have jurisdiction. What is the state court judge going to do? He's probably going to say, it is not up for me to make that determination as to whether or not the tribal court has jurisdiction of this case. You will have to take that up with the tribal court. Most of these courts and cases, you know, 90% will be in situations where that state judge and that tribal judge have a pretty good working relationship. They're in the same county. They know what those jurisdictional issues are. It will be somewhat complicated if we have situations where judges are not familiar with tribal jurisdiction.
That's why, Judge Moy, you said you hope that there were more cases that would come up on explaining what's exclusive versus concurrent jurisdiction. And Teague, if I remember, it was a contract breach case.
Yes, it was a contract case.
And the court said, oh, you both had jurisdiction, and here's how we're going to deal with that.
And see, the other aspect of this rule is I think it requires committees like ours and other individuals to continue this ongoing educational process between tribes and state courts, because more each tribe learns about how the other is operating, what is that tribe doing, and how are they doing it, and dealing with some of those educational aspects, I think the better the process will work, and that we hope is an advantage as well.
So I have one more question. Did your group study at all the possibility of a constitutional claim by a non-tribal member who has the right of jurisdiction in circuit courts and does not care to be transferred into tribal courts, but the judge believes the tribal court is the more appropriate forum?
Well, I think, and I don't know if the question is, would that discretionary call be appealable? I assume it would be.
No, that wasn't the question. My question was just whether you looked at whether there were any constitutional concerns on behalf of non-tribal member to being tried in a tribal court and excluded from state circuit court.
No.
Well, I did have the question about appeals. If there's a transfer, is it an appealable order?
Yeah.
Because it is a final order in a trial court.
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
Understanding, it would be, you know, abuse of discretion review, I would assume.
Judge, my recollection is that there are not jury trials in tribal court. Am I wrong?
For the most part, there are not.
Okay. Justice Rogenczyk put her finger on something that concerned me right from the beginning. There are certain constitutional rights that people have in circuit court, procedural rights, such as the right to a jury trial. And if we can conceive of a situation in which there is a tort case or a contracts case where it is absolutely undisputed that both courts have concurrent jurisdiction, I think this rule is saying that a party that files in circuit court and demands a jury trial can have that jury trial they have a right to under the Wisconsin Constitution, waived by a discretionary decision to send it to tribal court. I think that is profoundly troubling. And there may be other procedural rights, whether they're constitutional or whether they're statutory, that simply the judge makes a decision, I'm sending this to tribal court. And it would not be inappropriate in any way in terms of concurrent jurisdiction, but you're in effect giving the circuit court the right to simply take somebody's constitutional rights away.
I assume we can talk hypothetically about a lot of different scenarios. I assume if we had that case you were talking about, we could also have a result where it goes to jury trial in state court and also goes to trial in tribal court, and you end up with two decisions as we did in Teague, and then what are we going to do about it? We need to be realistic when we're dealing with two sovereigns, that somehow we have to come to an arrangement to best resolve situations. That's not to say that we might not have litigation over in this area. We probably will. But I would suggest to you that for 99% of the cases, for those judges in the trenches every day with litigants just looking for places to have their cases heard, that this mechanism will work quite well in doing that. We will get one of those cases, I'm sure, that will cause problems, and we'll have to address all those interesting issues. But I think as far as moving cases back and forth, I know, in especially dealing with some of these family matters, most of them were in state court because there were no tribal courts to hear them. We now have tribal courts that are interested in hearing these cases and, quite frankly, ought to be hearing those cases. And there needs to be some mechanism to let these cases be transferred when it makes sense that they've be heard there. And we are trying to do it on a concurrent level. It may be such that tribes have an infringement argument here that would suggest these cases that I'm talking about, mostly in the family matter, are exclusively within their realm as well. But we're going to run into those complicated cases where those facts are such that it's going to make it very difficult and somebody's going to have to make a call. And ultimately, that call will probably be this court as well. But we believe this is just another step in trying to help resolve cases. We have those allocation protocols, but that in essence is saying let's litigate, let's have conflict here to resolve issues, and we think we don't need to get there. We can stop that by just having discretionary calls, and I understand that there may be those that are troubled by that, and I guess we'll just have to see where that plays out. But I think for most cases, I think this rule would provide a great deal of assistance to state judges.
Judge Moore, if I could follow up Justice Prosser's question. In a situation where you have concurrent jurisdiction and you have a member of the tribe and you have a non-member of a tribe, and the non-member of the tribe were to object to a transfer of the jurisdiction, and the court might feel it's best that the case be transferred to a tribal court, was there any discussion of the committee at all about where there are either statutory or constitutional rights provided in the state court system, whether or not similar rights would be provided by the tribal courts in their jurisdiction?
Well, I don't. My feeling is we did not go to search out the expertise to try to find an answer to all of those kinds of questions. And I guess our response was we'll have to wait and see what the response is for that kind of situation. And we need to have cases. We need to have a lot of these come and be decided so that we have better guidance in those kind of issues. I mean, we can always look at what parameters exist for jurisdiction over non-Indians. And you can look at the Montana case and all those cases and make decisions. But ultimately, you know, if somebody's unhappy, it's going to go somewhere. And so we have some of that out there. But for the most part, most of the cases I'm seeing now are not those cases that contested. They really aren't. I mean, it's just a flow of cases back, I think, in many cases to the tribal courts that are now set up to hear them.
Questions relating to the different procedures of a tribal court and the circuit court are very much similar to the questions that came up in Teague. You had two courts, each recognized jurisdiction. There was no question about that. When it came to whether you should recognize the judgment of the tribal court, one of the issues was what were the procedures in the tribal court? To what extent did they differ or are they the same as in the state court? And what role should those different procedures play? which the court, I think, discussed at least as an issue. And maybe nine, your fact should be such other factors as may be appropriate in a particular case, including differences in procedure in the two courts.
Well, there isn't any question that tribal courts may seek other methods to resolve disputes. And no matter how you look at all our work to try to develop and promote these relationships, there will always be the tension between the adversarial process and a more consensual process of resolving disputes. And so that will always be there. And I understand what you are saying, and for the most part, it's interesting to see a lot of these tribal courts as they develop, and they seem to be picking the good of the adversarial process and the good of their cultural native processes to develop some kind of a mechanism to resolve disputes. And it's very fascinating and interesting to see how they are all doing that. And without question, you're going to have situations in which tribes resolve disputes differently. And I think that's the importance of this process, because I think in many cases tribes are in a much better position to provide long-lasting resolution of disputes through more culturally accepted methods than the adversarial process. And so I understand what you're saying, and you know, maybe at some point in time that standard or degree will be left as well to somebody else's decision.
Your Honor, I have a question.
There are people behind me here, too.
Oh, okay. Are you getting it? Judge Moore? Okay. I'll pass.
No, go ahead.
I just want to accommodate.
All right.
In the petition, there are nine factors that the court, in making such determination, the circuit court shall consider. My question is it the intent that these all nine factors be considered, or, and I understand that the ninth one is any other appropriate factor, but is it the intent that all of the factors be touched upon, or some of the factors? Do you have any response to that?
Well, again, it was our thought that we wanted to provide some standards, but we also wanted to make certain that the judges make a record as to what factors they think are appropriate in any given situation. It was not, at least my understanding, that they had to tick off every one to make the record that this one is present or isn't present. But again, that could be left to an appellate court to review as well.
The reason that I ask that is that in this mysterious editing of the draft by the Robert Nelson at the Legislative Reference Bureau, he amends the preface to that list of seven from what it says now, the circuit court shall consider, list of nine, and then the nine things are listed, to the circuit court shall consider all of the following, which is certainly a bit more specific. And if I would read the circuit court shall consider all the following, that suggests to me I better go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yes.
7, 8.
I would
nine.
Agree with you.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of whether or not shall consider all the following is advisable or is consistent with the intent? Any comment at all?
I don't think it would be consistent with our committee's intent. We expected judges to use their discretion, but essentially highlight those issues that are important in the case. And when you deal with comedy, that's one thing, as I reiterated, it is fact-specific. And it is very important that the judge highlights why, in this particular case, under all of these factors, this case ought to be one place or the other.
He also said the tribal court of a federally recognized American Indian tribe or band Should we add the words or banned? We can ask Judge Whitefish that.
Yeah, okay. It didn't appear to our committee that was something that needed to be in there.
All right.
Because we have federally recognized tribes here and do not have the ban.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You're excused for the moment. If you want to come back, after the hear others and summarize, Judge Moore, you're welcome. Judge Whitefish, Forest County Potawatomi Tribal Court. Judge Whitefish.
Bonjour, Nakanis. Gamas and Disney, cousin Makodu, Dame, Budawatomi, Nishnabe. I first want to say good morning to all of you justices. It's an honor to stand before you. Looking at the proposed 7-11, I glanced up from my seat, and I want to take it back a little bit further to the mural up on the wall that is here. I would guess that Chief Oshkosh was standing there for a reason, and that reason being for cooperation, coordination, and communication. And I don't compare myself to Chief Oshkosh, but it's still the same reason I am here. And I cannot speak for the 11 sovereign nations in the state of Wisconsin. I can speak for the Potawatomi, but I would be willing to go back and talk to my brothers of those 11 nations and find out exactly what it is that they want proposed. When walking on common ground came about, it comes about from justice for all. And in 2005, when walking on common ground came about, that's exactly what it was. The Pledge of Allegiance says, and for justice for all. And tribal courts look at that justice. But the thing about it is, nowadays in the common era that we live in, injustice for all, as I have heard the questions asked, the people of your sovereign nation also live in my sovereign nation. But I do not have jurisdiction over them because they do not belong to my people. They do not have or they are not enrolled in the Forest County Potawatomi tribe as I am. And as the people that I apply justice to, they have an enrollment number that says they belong to the Forest County Potawatomi tribe. As well as I know that Oneida is here, they have enrollment as well. And the courts of California said they were not going to come forth and dictate to the tribal nations their enrollment. Those are the people that we have jurisdiction over, exclusive jurisdiction of our tribal members. I am proud to say that I carry a card that exactly says that with an enrollment number on it. That the state of Minnesota said to their people, you have to accept that as a proper identification because that is the sovereign nation and where they belong. When we start talking about justice and justice for all, that walking on common ground, that's exactly what we talked about back then. It wasn't the arguing amongst each other of who had jurisdiction. Justice and I talked and we shared a podium together. That's what we talked about. The sharing of justice. If someone from your sovereign nation appears before me and has questioned if I have jurisdiction, I'm the first one going to say, Justice Butler, I don't believe you belong to this nation. I do not think you're a tribal member. So I don't think how this court has jurisdiction over you at this time. I am sorry, but I think you're in the wrong court system. And I would gladly defer that to Judge Moore's court. And say, I think this is where it belongs. There wouldn't be an argument, and I think for the rest of the judges and commissioners, even from Oneida and the 11 nations, would they argue that they want that jurisdiction? Butler, Justice Butler, you're out of here, we would say. You belong somewhere else. You belong in another sovereign nation.
Counselor, I mean, are you telling me, excuse me, Your Honor, are you telling me that you do not exercise jurisdiction over someone who's not a member of the Potawatomi tribe, even when one of the parties to the dispute is a member?
If they do not want to appear in our court, we don't have jurisdiction. If they're a non-Potawatomi, if they are married to a Potawatomi and they have a child together, we're talking of family matters like Judge Moore had talked, and they appear there, if they say, I don't want to appear in this court, I want to have this, and that's exactly where 7-11 comes forth, then the T protocol would kick in. The 7-11 I see is a more expedient way in handling justice because these children are out there waiting. The family is waiting.
I don't doubt that it's expedient for justice. I just guess I didn't understand, or maybe I misunderstood what you said, because I thought that the Potawatomi did exercise jurisdiction over non-members if one of the parties to the action was a member of the tribe. And although the court may look at whether the non-member wanted to be there or not, that really wasn't dispositive of jurisdiction as a subject matter concept.
In some instances, yes, we do exercise, but it's usually if they're working within the boundaries of our jurisdiction, of our land boundaries, such as Milwaukee, that we own the land there. Up north, we own the land there. If they are employed by us or they're working within our jurisdiction, they fall then upon within our jurisdiction in order to handle it. Our tribal court does. But if they are living outside of it, we have no jurisdiction of them. If they have a family out there and it's with a Potawatomi tribal member, and that child then is a Potawatomi tribal member, yes, then we do. But we also listen to them. Do you want, and if they have the right to say, I do not want this. Even our own tribal members that don't live within the boundaries of our community and say, no, I don't want this handled in this jurisdiction, even in the Indian Child Welfare Act. It states if they argue and they don't want it handled by tribal court, it's then handled by state court.
I see. Thank you.
So there is some parameters already ahead. That's the reason I wanted to talk about that, was exactly that. And the reason I entered what I had said in my own Potawatomi language, I greeted you in a very respectful way. Then I told you who I was, but you didn't understand that. Maybe Justice Bradley did, though. But if you didn't understand that, that's exactly some of each nation, the 11 nations within Wisconsin sometimes, Ho-Chunk is a very good example of that. They have a very traditional court. In that court system, the only language that is spoken is Ho-Chunk. I don't speak Ho-Chunk. It would be very unfamiliar to me. And they have procedure ways in order to do it. And if we look at the cooperation and coordination, what are we talking about? We're going back to almost this time. In our country, and I'm sure in a lot of other Native countries, we call that respect. The respect of it. The respect of your court system. The respect of mine. Oneidas, the 11 nations within the state of Wisconsin. This is what I have seen grown since the time I have been a judge in 1994 when I came aboard. It has grown tremendously. And each and every one of you, I have the privilege when I sat in here and watched the Supreme Court in action, I looked at each and every one of you and says, I know them. Because of the cooperation and coordination that it has taken between tribal courts, state courts, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Wisconsin is looked as a leader in tribal and state forums, in cooperation and coordination, and not an argument of jurisdiction. I am the president of the National American Indian Court Judges Association. I have been the president. I'm going on my fourth consecutive term. And it makes me proud that being a president from Wisconsin, and especially from the Forest County Potawatomi, when they say, we look at Wisconsin, and you, Wisconsin, are the leader when it comes to forums and not arguing about which jurisdiction or where it belongs, that how do you get your state court judges, your Supreme Court, and the federal judges to even sit down and willingly talk with issues regarding the jurisdiction? Wisconsin is looked very highly upon. And I'm not saying that just for my benefit, but I don't know if the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you've been told that. Because I have heard it in my travels as the NYJA president. I've served my people proudly since 1994, the Forest County Potawatomi. And I hope I have also served partially the other tribes in the state of Wisconsin. This is no infringement upon your sovereignty, no infringement upon the 11 tribes' sovereignty, as I see it. Otherwise, I wouldn't stand before you. Because sovereignty in my heart is for my people, as it is for the Menominee, the Oneida, the Ho-Chunks, and all the other 11 tribal nations within the state of Wisconsin. We are very fortunate in the state of Wisconsin that we have 11 nations. And 11 nations that can come together with the other sovereign nation, the state of Wisconsin, and to come up with a rule, 7-11, to let the state court judges have that discretionary power to transfer to tribal courts. Now, before I came aboard as a judge and was elected by my people, we didn't have a court system. There's a lot of tribes that have grown just leaps and bounds, and I know each and every one of you has seen it, to where they are handling their own matters. And yes, sometimes their forums may be a little different, such as the way I introduced myself. You were here. But that's when Chief Oshkosh appeared before these people. They had their own court system, but it wasn't called that. My family had my own court system. There was no higher law than Grandma's law. There is no appeal to Grandma's law either. That's my family. And each and every one of you have your own justice in your family. But our 11 nations also had a justice system long before that now the Western Cultural Society court system that a lot of us, some of us, use. But I know some of our nations are looking to other the forms of dispute resolution going back to something maybe that Chief Oshkosh and what he did with his people. Maybe it was Grandma's rule where you sat down before the elders. And I know there was no appeal. When my elder tells me something, there is no appeal to my elder. I go to my elder, I have a problem, my elder will tell me how to take care of it. Doesn't matter if I like his, what they tell me, that's the way it has to be done. I look at everything that the state of Wisconsin has done. The Wisconsin Supreme Court, each and every one of your involvement. When this came about, walking on common ground, that's where I think it all started, because all of us had a real concern, and that was justice in the state of Wisconsin. And I believe it's being addressed in the sovereignty, the exclusive jurisdiction. I guess the exclusive jurisdiction, we all know what exclusive jurisdiction means. And when Judge Morris said that the federal government, I think, was just trying to get out of handling native matters and handed down public law 280 instead of the state of Wisconsin, you deal with it. I think it was kind of handing us natives off to the state of Wisconsin as a problem child.
And I say five that, others.
And I say that humorously.
Judge Whitefish, is it appropriate to say the tribal court of a federally recognized tribe, or is it federally recognized tribal nation, or a federally recognized tribe or band? What's the appropriate reference?
I guess I would have to defer then to the attorneys in each respective sovereign nation.
Okay. We'll get a response.
I think it would, as my suggestion, and Judge Ackley also, just as it would be coming from me, it would be federally recognized tribes /bands, because your Chippewas, there is how many?
Five?
Was it six? What we're dealing with, though, is the word...
Band.
Excuse me, the federal recognized band.
Yeah.
Band or tribe is correct. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Good. Thank you.
May I?
Judge Brasser. Versus Brasser.
Judge Whitefish, you made a very eloquent statement. And speaking for myself, I think it is exceptionally important for the courts of this state to always communicate with an open mind and in good faith with the tribal courts in this state. But I think part and parcel of that communication is the willingness to discuss some of the tough issues, not just the easier issues. As I look at this petition, I see the overwhelming thrust as entirely positive, well worthwhile, but there's some little concerns, at least for me. I look at all of the tribal members in Wisconsin. They are also citizens of Wisconsin. They are entitled to every constitutional right that any other citizen of this state enjoys. I can think of hypotheticals in which two tribal members on a matter of concurrent jurisdiction might file in circuit court because of certain rights that are afforded under the Wisconsin Constitution. Under those circumstances, I don't think the circuit court ought to be sending that back to the tribal court. What I don't quite see in this petition is exactly what Justice Rogensack referred to, some explicit consideration of the views of the litigants. Because, I mean, frankly, we would understand that if someone started a case in tribal court, that should be fully considered. And one party said, I want to start this in tribal court, absolutely. But if someone picks a different forum, that is the circuit court, well, there's something about that that ought to be considered as well. And that's all I'm saying here. I'm sure that this can be worked out satisfactorily, but I think the views of the litigants and the rights under the Wisconsin Constitution that might be given up are something I think needs to be considered.
If I may, and I don't, and I apologize ahead of time. I don't want to be trying to. I just want to share what information I have, and what education I have with you. According to the Indian Civil Rights Act, which the federal guidelines also apply, that also applies to our tribal nations. I mean, in there, their rights are given. In my sovereign nation, they do have a right to a jury trial. They do have a right to a jury trial. They have a right to appeal as well. But in my nation of about 1,100 tribal members, about 1,150, I would guess, if you ask for a jury trial, you're probably going to be tried by one of your cousins. All right? So that's the reason that very few jury trials are requested in my court system.
Because they'll lose.
They don't want to be tried by their relatives. That's where grandma's law comes in. All right? In a United Nation, because they're a lot, and Ho-Chunk is a lot larger, they also, I know, have jury trials, or, you know, they are afforded jury trials if they so wish to be desired. Picking a forum, I believe, which court system they want to be heard, as we all know that I think the people that appear before us will try to pick the easiest court system that they think is going to be less punitive on us, on them. And in our court system, they're made to jump through hoops. And the bottom of my court system in my courtroom is cedar.
I'm sorry, is
cedar, the wood cedar. It's made out of cedar. The bottom of it's cedar, and it represents a healing in our community, in our nation. Cedar is used as that. The top is just out of, used to be out of wallboard. However, that has changed a lot of my courtroom now because it's new, is made out of cedar because of the concept of the healing. The punitive, from my cultural perspective, grandmothers and especially aunties and grandmothers, they told their children first. They told them, don't touch that. That's hot. In our communities, a lot of times you go back, we had heaters that were with wood. And as a child, you didn't know it was hot until you went over there and touched it. And like all of us did, we didn't understand hot, so we had to go touch it and get burnt. Some of those people, they continue to go back and see if it's still hot, and they continue to get burnt. And sometimes the court systems deal with that. However, when we look at that perspective and that healing, if they're never told it's hot, they're going to automatically touch it. That's the way, the reason the cedar was put there as a teaching, and not to be punitive, but at some times when our aunties or our grandmothers or our uncles and our grandmas, or grandpas, I mean, teach them, at some time then it has to become punitive because you've already been taught that lesson. You have been told this is the correct way to do. Now it's time to be punitive. And in our court system, it looks at that. We look at the healthiness of our community or those people that appear before us and ask them if they know that lesson. And for every lesson that is out here, there is also usually a tribal, culturally lesson that can be learned from that. So, I mean, there's two worlds that these people walk in, the same way as two court systems that they can choose from. I would not deny, and I don't think any of the other 11 nations would ever deny rights to an individual that appears before them. Even back when we didn't have a court system and our elders possibly handled some of those, they always had the right to speak. In my court system, you don't have to have a $200 attorney speak for you. You have the right to speak for yourself, because sometimes they tell us it comes from your old amen. And that's the reason some of the judges are elected, because they can feel that from those people that stand before them. From their heart is the reason we want to hear from them. And sometimes in our court system, in my court system, I listen to those aunties and those grandmas and those uncles and those grandpas, because they'll be the first ones to tell on them.
Judge Whitefish, let me ask you this. With respect to the concerns that have been raised by Justice Rogan-Sack and Justice Prosser, I'm looking at the petition as originally drafted, 711 on page 8, and I'm looking at the petition that's been marked up by Mr. Nelson of the Legislative Reference Bureau. One of the factors that has been listed for consideration by the courts, and I'm going to read it, whether the parties have by contract chosen a form or the law to be applied in the event of a dispute. And you may not know the answer to this question. This may be a better question for Judge Moore or for a member of the committee. But to the best of your knowledge, do you have any idea why the words "or by contract" was inserted there? And if there is no legitimate reason for the words "by contract" to be there, what would be your reaction to having the consideration, one of the factors to be considered, reading whether the parties have chosen a form or the law to be applied in the event of a dispute? That may address the concerns that Justice Prosser and Justice Rogan-Sack have. It's a consideration the court would still have in play. You're looking at the interests of the parties. They have at least a say in the matter. Whereas when you add the words "by contract," it implies they have to agree. And I think their concern is what happens when they disagree. So I don't know if that's something that was discussed. I don't know if it's something that you've thought about. And I don't know if you have a reaction to my question. But and I admit it may be unfair to spring it on you since you aren't a member of the committee.
Justice Butler, you're putting me in a very precarious, because I can't, I really can't answer that.
And I appreciate that, Jeff.
I don't believe, because I don't know the intent that it was written, because the
forum I think that it comes from Teague, which was a contract case,
yeah.
And in which, in contracts, people do contract for a forum, or might, or contract for the law, and I bet that's where it comes from. And I think that's perfectly acceptable as such. If you want to do what Justice Butler says, you can add another nine, the wishes of the litigants, the views of the litigants. But the contract is put in for that particular purpose. Doesn't mean you have to keep it that way, but that's where I think it comes from. Judge Whitefish?
Yes.
Let me, on behalf of the court, say how much we've appreciated your long work with not only this aspect of the Tribal Forum, but previous incarnations of and iterations of the Tribal Forum, and your continued working with the state court system. You're bringing new tribal courts to the circuit courts and inviting circuit court judges to your tribal courts so that each can learn from the other. And you're coming to this court with tribal judges to see the workings of an appellate court. So many thanks to you and to your tribal court, as well as to the tribal courts of all 11 federally recognized tribes or bands.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you.
Again, I say thank you for making me shine on a national level because of our coordination. Our
anytime,
talking.
Judge, anytime.
Have a good day.
Judge Anderson, Bayfield County Circuit Court.
Good morning. I am authorized to extend greetings from Judge Donald Gurnall from the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And for the first time in my nearly 45 years of existing, I've never had to think about whether it's a tribe or a band until today. We'll have to go back and talk about that. I don't want to take up much of the justice's time. I would like to talk just briefly about some of the practical applications of this proposal with some examples that have happened in my circuit court, some of which have been touched upon already, and then end it with a somewhat more esoteric statement, as I think the justices have pointed out that there are certainly things to think about with this. In the last 12 months, I have had two divorce cases come before me in Bayfield County, filed by members of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, the Ojibwe. In both cases, they were pro se, and unfortunately, in both cases, they had to file the, I believe it's now over $200 filing fee to file their divorce in Bayfield County. The Red Cliff Tribal Court has been exercising jurisdiction over divorces now for a few years. Neither one of these two families actually knew that. They were not familiar that they could actually file for divorce in their own tribal court. So they started the process in Bayfield County, went through almost the entire waiting period, the 120-day waiting period before the divorce can be finalized. I think they were both cases involving children, so the parents went through our children in the middle course, which we require in our county. And then they both came to court for a final hearing at separate times, and they asked me together, Judge Anderson, we really would like to move this to tribal court. We weren't aware that we could get divorced in tribal court. And I said, well, that's perfectly fine with me if you would like to simply refile in the Red Cliff Tribal Court and do that. And, of course, they didn't know how to ask the question, well, can't you just send it up there and we can take care of it? And I had to tell them they have to just simply, I'll be happy to enter a dismissal order if that's what they're asking me to do, and they can then refile in the tribal court. Now, I don't know if they had to pay a filing fee in the tribal court. I suspect there is some fee. But they essentially decided, for cultural reasons, to start it all over again in the tribal court. If this mechanism was in place, I could have very easily transferred, based upon both parties' request, in a very simple everyday affair that we handle weekly in every court in this state and across the nation, a mechanism in which we could simply transfer the matter to the tribal court efficiently, easily, and without any great delay by the parties. That is the practical consideration, and I think Justice Prosser has pointed out that the many will be treated fairly and efficiently by this proposal, and that is really the crux of what we're doing here, because we do see at the circuit court level so many of these cases that come in either pro se or there's one party that's represented, perhaps another party is not, where there are concurrent jurisdictional issues, where oftentimes they simply chosen the forum out of almost habit as opposed to if they had known. Those are the examples that I would like to extend to the court, that these are the practical considerations that occur on a weekly basis in our court systems. Now, that is not to say that there aren't going to be troubles and issues that come up as we handle these concurrent jurisdictional cases. You know, we are the first generation that has to deal primarily with the evolution of the tribal courts as they begin to mature and come together. And with all things, there's a first time. This is the first step, or one of the first steps in that process. And because we are the first generation that has to deal with, we're going to have to deal with the tough issues too. And Justice Prosser, you're exactly right. There are going to be times when perhaps there are very strong constitutional considerations and fundamental fairness considerations that have to be taken into consideration. And I suspect when those cases come up, in the rarity that they will, somebody, this court or a federal court, will have to deal with it. But that's true of almost every rule we pass and every law that we pass. There's always going to be the loophole, so to speak, or something we haven't thought of. And that's why we have courts to make those final decisions.
Isn't it also possible that as we move into this new phase of an interaction between the state courts and the tribal courts, that perhaps there ought to be a provision that says that both parties have to consent to the change? That would certainly get rid of the constitutional concerns that I have. And I don't know how Justice Prosser feels about this because I haven't talked to him about it, but it's possible that you could accomplish the kinds of things you wanted to accomplish for those parties who wanted to be in tribal court and didn't know they could be there, and eliminate the problem of someone who doesn't want the transfer based on what they perceive to be stronger or rights that they prefer under a Wisconsin circuit court that wouldn't be present in a tribal court.
Well, that's a possibility. It would certainly create a situation where we would simply fall back, in that case, almost to a Teague situation, where we would have to do the Teague protocol, at least in my district, where we may have the same constitutional issues that evolve, and we have to discuss which court is the appropriate forum. And those constitutional issues might exist in a traditional Teague case, just as they would in a discretionary transfer case.
And I don't think we've ruled on a challenge to the Teague protocol in a constitutional fashion either. I don't think that's ever been brought before this court.
I'm not aware of it. I don't think it's happened in this state, and whether it's happened or there is something similar in other jurisdictions, I'm not aware of. That's certainly a consideration, but ultimately, in those tough cases, you know, you're going to have a situation where they're simply not going to agree, and somebody's going to have to make the tough call, and we're going to have to balance. I'm sorry, Chief.
No, go ahead.
You're going to have to balance, all the factors, the statutory factors, and also the constitutional factors of due process and fundamental fairness.
But you'll be changing constitutional rights over an objection based on a discretionary determination of the circuit court, not a... that's a very broad standard and one that's very difficult to appeal with success.
If we assume that the same constitutional protections are not going to apply at the tribal court level, which they may or they
may not.
But
they
may
not, right.
That is, unfortunately, one of the fundamental problems of having these sovereign entities coexisting with us.
Sure.
And part of the process as we evolve through this is not only do we respect their sovereign nation and their sovereign rules, but we have to trust that they will also evolve and do things in such a way that the best interest of the community and fundamental fairness will evolve as well. It's difficult, though, for judges and justices to think about not protecting litigants' final rights in some manner or the other when you're applying that concept to now a sovereign culture that may not necessarily have the same rules.
Right,
that
but
we have.
We are sworn as judges to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin, and it is a charge I take very seriously, which is why I'm very concerned about the lack of a study of this. Now, if Judge Moore had told me, yeah, they studied this, they looked into it, this is what they found, that is what they found, I would feel somewhat better. To me, it appears this has simply been overlooked, and I think it's a serious consideration.
Well, I think you're right that it is a serious consideration. Perhaps it's overlooked simply because there's no guidance on it. And the only way to get guidance,
that's the Constitution.
I'm afraid. Well, I mean, I understand that. But there is little in the way of a case law to guide us on how these constitutional issues and individual rights are affected by concurrent jurisdictional issues. And so my statement is, there's a first time for everything, and I'm afraid this is one of the areas of the law that we're just going to have to watch evolve,
yeah,
as it was going to anyway.
There's a fair amount of federal law on Public Law 280.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, the federal law, you know, it goes as far. I'll give you an example, and it's off the point, but it's an example in my court in the last 2 months whereby I had a criminal trial. And the defendant subpoenaed a tribal employee to come testify in a felony battery case. The tribe raised the issue that we are not subject to your subpoena power. We are sovereign, and therefore we do not have to honor the subpoena. And we're telling you as a courtesy that we're not going to show up, but we don't have to show up. Now, of course, that shocked the system a little bit. Not only mine, but the defendant. But there is some federal law that appears to back that up outside of this circuit. It's a difficult set of issues as to what true fundamental fairness is and where the constitutional rights of someone's due process and the right to a fair trial might be impeded by a sovereign entry saying, I'm sorry, but you don't have any jurisdiction over our employees.
Judge Anderson, if the parties disagree as to whether to be in circuit court or in tribal court, the party who wants it in tribal court can, if the trial court judge refuses to transfer for any reason, the person can go to tribal court, file the lawsuit there, proceed to judgment, which is probably going to be faster than in the circuit court because, I mean, that's what happened, for example, in Teague. And then you're left with two, potentially. Maybe you will reach one judgment in both cases. You will then be left with two conflicting judgments by two courts who have concurrent jurisdiction. I made assumptions there because if they don't, you don't have to worry about any of this. And then you go into a comedy situation of whether the circuit court is going to accept the tribal court judgment, which is the same kind of comedy that we're talking about here. So the only issue is whether you're going to do it pre-judgment, like here, or you're going to do it post-judgment, as in Teague.
Yes, and certainly in some Teague situations, the Teague protocol would be invoked prior to judgment anyway.
Yeah.
I can tell you as a practical matter, and every court handles this differently, how this would be handled in Bayfield County with the Red Cliff Tribal Court is if the issue came up by one or more of the litigants about transferring it. The first thing that would happen, and I've called it the mini-Teague or the abbreviated Teague, but the first thing that I would do is I would call the sitting judge in Redcliffe, number one, to find out, are you handling these types of cases, first of all? I need to find that out because I may not know. And number two, is there anything that you would see as stopping this from happening from a practical or legal standpoint? So we would probably have, and I think most counties would do this, you would have some type of communication to go back and
forth.
Would
you do it on the record?
I would then put the conversation on the record or invite the judge or a representative to show up. And I do think that the even though it's reasonably simple language, it does the proposal does call for notice and hearing. So I don't see that we would be doing this in any situation without appropriate notice and hearing to let all parties participate one way or the other. So with that, that's all I have.
Thank you.
Judge, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
You spoke initially in your remarks about two divorce cases. And it seems, I can't imagine that there's going to be any big issue about a situation where you're in Bayfield County and it's the Redcliffe tribe or another tribe very close by. But what if the two people were from a tribe from Minnesota or the UP? It seems to me sort of logical that that would also apply. But once you say it does, we're talking about all kinds of other cases under the language of this proposed rule. How should we interpret the language of the rule?
Well, if we're talking about, an out-of-state tribe or sovereign nation that you may want to transfer it into or a request has been made, I still think you're going to have to deal with, issues of, who has jurisdiction and does the circuit court even have jurisdiction, both subject matter and personal, over the litigants. I think we still have to get over that hump first. And I think even though the other court may have to take up the exact same issue, whether or not they even have jurisdiction over it, I have to admit, I don't think our committee ever discussed what would happen transferring out of state.
Well, this rule wouldn't cover that either. Then they'd have to, if they both agreed, they'd refile with the tribe of their choosing, right?
Right.
You wouldn't have authority to transfer this to a different state, a different tribe in a different state under this rule.
Under its four corners, I don't think it necessarily calls
for that. Well, it's easy to solve that just by putting in a recognized tribe in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, yes.
As a concurrent jurisdiction of the matter, and that would finish that.
I can't speak for my other circuit court judges, but
that doesn't mean they don't end up there. They could just refile there and dismiss it, but if they didn't want to dismiss it in your court, you're stuck under your oath applying the law. If a party wants to show up, they do, and if they don't, they don't. You've got to decide the case before you.
Right. I think that's probably fair. It would be very difficult for, at least for me personally, to be dealing with this transferring out of state, and I would be very, very, very hesitant.
It's hard enough to do from circuit court in Wisconsin to circuit court in Minnesota, let alone circuit tribal circuit.
Right. Yes, that's true.
Well, Judge, is it simply my observation that the language of this proposed rule was broader than 806.245, the full faith and credit? I mean, and I assume if this had been fully considered, that a judgment was made why words in Wisconsin were not in there.
I'm going by memory now, and I'm trying to think if it was an act of omission or something that... I think we were presuming all along that we were talking about Wisconsin only. I think that's fair to say. I think that's fair to say. So I don't think the committee would have any objection to modifying it to make sure that was clear. This is hard enough.
Okay.
And it's gotten harder in the last hour and a half.
You haven't seen anything yet, Judge. That's for sure.
You thought it was simple, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
As I was driving through the fog last night thinking, well, this isn't that hard. We should be.
We ought to be out of here in an hour. Okay.
If there's no other questions, thank you.
We have people waiting for the second one, too. Thank you, Judge Anderson. Thank you for your services on this committee, and thank you for your appearance today. Representative Gary Sherman, member of the Legislative Council Special Committee on State-Tribal Relations. Good seeing you, Attorney Representative Sherman.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, Honorable Justices. It's a lot of fun to be here. I want to tell you, I miss this. Actually, it's been so long that there's three members of the court who weren't even here the last time I was here. Well, speaking of comity, I represent a co-equal branch of the government, and I am a member of the forum, and I am a member of the forum by virtue of being a member of the Joint Ledge Council Special Committee on State-Tribal Relations. I was assigned, well, I suppose requested by the chair, Terry Musser, to sit on the forum as the representative of the Ledge Council Special Committee. And I want to take just a second to back up, first of all, with a housekeeping matter, and that is I understand that the petition says that the committee has reviewed the petition, and actually that's not true. Other than my own participation in drafting and reviewing the petition, the committee actually hasn't met since the petition was filed. So they haven't had the opportunity to do that. But I'm here on behalf of the committee. The special committee was formed in the legislature, quite possibly by Speaker Prosser, I'm not sure, but at a time of great conflict in Wisconsin over conflicting jurisdictions over things that had to do primarily with hunting and fishing. And really at this point in time, we have reached another stage in the relationship between the state and the tribes. We are not specifically anymore in the stage of trying to resolve conflict. We've moved beyond that into the stage of trying to create day-to-day life, of trying to create normalization of relationships. And this petition reflects the maturity of our relationship between the state of Wisconsin and the tribes in the state of Wisconsin. You know, a maturity that maybe was hard won in the many years since the trial of Oshkosh. And I remembered, I like to give tours of the building. I'm sure most of you like to give tours of the building. And this is my second favorite room in the building, my favorite room being 320 West, my office. I always make a point of bringing people here, you know, and giving the Raleigh Day explanation of the murals, because I think it is very poignant and telling that as long ago as territorial days, the need for comity was recognized. And again, in a completely different period of time, at the time the building was built, almost 100 years ago, the importance of that comity was again recognized when the murals for this room were designed. And now here we are, you know, 100 years later, and we're talking about how we institutionalize that comity into day-to-day life, into the normal operations rather than the exceptional operations of courts. And I think that's a very important step. And I'm really pleased that we're here. And Judge Light, and like Judge Whitefish, I'm proud that we have reached this stage of things. I want to just make a couple of comments related to some of the questions that have come up. And then I'll sit down and you can move on. I want to start out with talking about the purposes section, because I have this constant dispute with the Legislative Reference Bureau in drafting, that they don't like any indication of legislative intent to be put right into laws. And quite frankly, you know, as a lawyer and a person who's done statutory interpretation in the courts, I feel that it's very useful in certain kinds of situations, not all the time, but certainly in First Amendment cases and things like that, to have a specific statement of legislative intent, and I think this may be one of those cases. So I would urge on you to consider very carefully before taking the advice of the LRB in taking out of the language the purpose section, because I think it can be useful not only in statutory interpretation, but when you're trying to consider appeals. Now, I know you have a constant problem with the record on appeal when the issue is the discretion of the trial court judge. You frequently make reference in your opinions to wishing a better record had been made by the trial court judge when discretion is exercised, and what law and what facts have been referred to. And I do think that this purpose section will also be helpful in that regard, in helping the trial court judge to understand what should be put into the record. And that's also how I view the 9 standards that are in there, as being largely a tool for the trial court judge, to help the trial court judge see what kind of a record to make in making the transfer. And I think that your idea of putting in the wishes of the litigants as a major factor is a very important idea. I agree with that completely, but I also agree with leaving in the part about by contract. Just as today it has become so common in contracts for arbitration to be required. And by the way, arbitration to be required in contracts where both of the parties don't always have any right to negotiate the contract. You know, it could be on your parking ticket when you park in a ramp. It could be on things that you buy more or less from a big box store or things like that, and those arbitration requirements are often enforceable, but they do cause people to give up their constitutional rights essentially against their will, even though they've contracted for them. I think by contract is a very important thing to leave in there, because employment contracts, which as in the Teague case, are as likely as not going to be an issue, what the parties have contracted is a very important thing to know. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that you need to say more generally that the judge should certainly consider the desires of the parties as one of those major factors. I'm not so sure that we should require that both parties positively assent or consent. You might want to require that they not dissent, but I think there's a big difference, because pretty often it's hard to serve both parties. It's hard to get both parties actually actively in the courtroom at the same time to give that consent. So you might want to make it more passive rather than active if you want to go that route. But I don't really see, as a practical matter, that that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking, for the most part, about the exceptional cases. We're talking about day-to-day life. And I have a hard time envisioning a circuit court judge, any circuit court judge that I've worked with, shoving parties into tribal court where somebody vociferously objects to going there. That just doesn't seem real likely. I mean, we're giving this discretion to the circuit court, after all. And judges are programmed to make decisions and not to give them away if they can. So I think those are the things that I wanted to comment on. I thought about the out-of-state thing and also about the rights waiver in the same context, and that is we allow other countries to hear cases that might arise here. For example, in child custody cases, we may defer to an ongoing case in Mexico. We accept Mexican divorces. You know, I mean, we know that that child custody case in Mexico is not going to be heard exactly the same way that we would hear it here, but under our procedure, if it's already pending, we defer to the Mexican court. And I've had cases like that in my own family. So, I just want to mention that we're dealing with a sovereign. It's almost like dealing, not quite, but almost like dealing with a foreign country, certainly with a foreign state, is equivalent. And we need to bear in mind that arises in other contexts. We're not really reinventing the wheel here. This is something that happens in other contexts, like arbitration, foreign countries. You know, we do these things. And what we're really talking about is a simple way for us to develop a relationship and develop confidence and develop institutions that I think are going to be beneficial to everybody. And like John, when I was driving down in the fog yesterday, I thought this was a simple matter. And as always, I'm educated by all of you. You're always so probing, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sherman. And
I'm sorry, Justice.
Representative, you and I ran into each other a couple of days ago. You said you were looking forward to this and that you'd entertain tough questions.
Yes, I did.
All right. And I've been thinking about that.
I knew you would.
Oh, we have you to thank.
Yes, it's my fault. I warned everybody this morning, too.
The tribal forum, I suppose, could have sought a draft rule with this court, a petition with this court, or it could have gone a legislative route. Was there discussion of that, and why was the decision made to have a petition?
Absolutely, there was discussion of that, and I have to say that one of the reasons why we chose to go this route was my encouragement that this would be a more appropriate route to go for this kind of a procedural matter. So, I mean, yes, we definitely discussed it. In fact, we were talking this morning about, you know, we discussed this when we had a meeting at the St. Croix Chippewa. And that was specifically the topic of the discussion. And I see this court as having a much stronger role in making procedural rules than the legislature.
Although it is concurrent.
Yes, it is indeed. And we approach each other very carefully sometimes in terms of comity, because we've had a few fights about that last session. So,
a very politic answer, Representative.
Well, he's had so much time to think about it.
That's the best you can do, huh? No, you actually, you've really made this a lot more interesting discussion than I ever anticipated it was going to be. So that's true.
Representative Sherman, as I was starting to say, we appreciate your serving. We appreciate your coming. And I think this is yet another example of, over the years, the legislative and judicial branches cooperating and collaborating where they easily can for a more effective and efficient administration of justice in this state. So thank you, and thank your colleagues.
Thank you, and thank this honorable court, and I really appreciate not having the lights on.
Attorney Artis, Black River Falls.
First, I would like to thank all of you very much for the opportunity to be here and to apologize for being as hoarse as I am. I am an attorney in private practice in Black River Falls. I have been involved with Indian law since 1991, when I graduated law school. I served on the Wisconsin Gaming Commission as Deputy General Counsel. I was at the Department of Revenue, where I handled almost exclusively Indian tax law matters. I went to work for the Ho-Chunk Nation as a legislative counselor for 3 years, and at the end of that period, I liked Black River Falls, and I stayed. It was that simple. I would like to thank Judge Whitefish for acknowledging the traditional court of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Fortunately for me, they don't always speak Ho-Chunk, because I would be completely in the dark. The rest of the court, however, does operate in English and Ho-Chunk when requested, and the Ho-Chunk Nation does have a jury trial system. But as Judge Whitefish pointed out, one of the biggest problems that you have is, in a nation of 6,400 people, finding someone that you're not related to may be impossible. And many, many cases are heard by a judge for that reason. Family law is extremely important in the Ho-Chunk Nation. The feeling of family is very important in that nation. And the courts in the Ho-Chunk Nation have increasingly taken a role in divorce matters. Another area of family law, probably the ultimate act in family law, has been probate. And in that area, I'd like to just draw your attention to Section 2, Item Number 2, whether the action involves traditional or cultural matters of the tribe. One of the words that sometimes gets danced around would be religious convictions, the opportunity to exercise one's religion. In a situation where there is a dispute in probate, it is possible that the convictions of the people who are involved in this, based upon religious beliefs and what happens in the afterlife for someone who dies and who has expressed their wishes on their deathbed, which is a traditional Ho-Chunk way of doing things, will not be followed. It has to be news to some situations that there is not even a holographic will, but simply an oral will. And the expression of things, which has been done successfully for thousands of years, the Ho-Chunk people who are believers in this feel that's the way it should be. And it is extremely difficult, and I understand why it is so difficult, to convey that to a court, and frequently, in my situation right now, to opposing counsel. And to discover that I was the third attorney consulted by a family after the previous attorney said, don't even bother with the Ho-Chunk court. You'll never get a fair shake in the Ho-Chunk court. Well, that's what I inherited, and that's what I've been dealing with. And it's uphill, believe me.
You in favor of this or not?
I'm very much in favor of this.
Okay. Are you in favor of one of the factors being involves traditional or cultural matters?
Very much, but I would like to add religion in there.
Are we going to raise First Amendment problems?
Well, I think there's a First Amendment problem if it isn't recognized as a religious issue as well.
Isn't the word cultural a broad enough umbrella to encompass religion?
Or traditional?
I don't think so, because culture encompasses things such as artwork and all of the rest of that.
Depending on your definition of culture, I guess.
Pardon me?
My definition of culture is...
Would yours include religion? Well, as long as that's... that's considered, that would be very good.
When you study a culture, you know, when an anthropologist studies a culture...
Right.
You study all, you know, not just the music and the dancing, but their social norms, their religious myths are all part of it.
As long as those things can be taken into account, I think that works then, and you may not need the issue of religion. But it's also possible for a litigant to say, I'm being denied the opportunity to practice my religion.
By being in the circuit court.
Pardon me?
By being in the circuit court that doesn't recognize an oral will.
That could be an issue.
Right,
based on the tradition there in the Ho-Chunk Nation. The problems that you're grappling with are very, very old problems. I, too, noticed the painting. And maybe because I'm a life member of the NRA, I noticed that the only people with guns were the Europeans. And that the natives are in the corner. And that, in some ways, has been a problem which I have experienced in representing the Ho-Chunk Nation. In particular, the contract issue came up in a negotiation. And it was very difficult to persuade a multinational company that wanted to have everything done in the courts and under the laws of California that there was a court in the Ho-Chunk Nation that could sit down and interpret California law. And that the Ho-Chunk would not sign the contract unless it were to be in their courts. And the response from one person that I discussed the problem with was, explain that we can read and write. You know?
Counselor, could I bring you back to the statement you made about jury trials? Under your understanding of the Ho-Chunk's rules of conducting a trial, is the right to a jury trial a right that is absolute in someone who asks for it, or is it conditioned on
everyone? Absolute.
It's absolute. So if you ask for it, then you have to have a jury trial.
Yes, you have to ask for it.
And does it apply to all kinds of civil actions or just to some?
As far as I know, it applies to all. I haven't had exposure to all.
Thank you.
Focus again on this. Are there, other than the religious aspect, is there anything else you would change in this?
I think the only real problem can be the word expeditiously, which means something in one situation depending upon the load of the
which
court.
Number
that
is
would
that?
Be item number 8. where something would be decided most expeditiously.
What would you change it to?
I think the word is fine as it is. I just think that expeditious is open to interpretation if it's referring only to speed.
Anything else, Mr. Arndes?
No, I think that this is a very, very good rule, and I hope that it is adopted. I believe that the preamble is extremely useful in this. I don't have any problem with legislative intent. It certainly helps me, and I think it helps anybody that sit down and grapple with the rule. I wasn't offended by it, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you.
And I feel as though I've taken the ultimate blue book exam following a series of judges in front of the Supreme Court and also with a judge from my home county in the room. That's.
Well, you passed.
I hope so.
Right. I hope flying colors, Mr. Arndes.
Thank you very much. Could I? Is that on the record?
On the record. You cannot use it as an ad.
An unpublished opinion?
Right, exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Thank you. I'll take
just
what I can get.
Just among us friends.
I'll take what I can get.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you. Stanley Webster, Oneida Tribal Judicial System, asked to speak. Good seeing you again. Good morning.
I'm glad that you're having this meeting for consideration for recognition of who we are as a people here. In 1990, we had a forum on sovereignty. I don't know if any of you were on the bench then. 1990. Chief Justice Heffernan, we worked with him, and we had a forum on sovereignty to talk about almost the same thing that we're talking about that's being discussed here today. And it was in Stevens Point. And we had over 300 people that came in for that from the tribes. And one of the things that we had when we were there in our discussion was that we were talking about why we do what we do for each sovereign aspect of government to say why they do what it is that they do. And they have to support it according to their rules, according to their sovereignty. We had several pictures made of this. Cost a few dollars. We had to get the Supreme Court's permission. And then we gave that out, and I still have one left yet at my house. And I don't know what to do with it.
We have one, so don't. We have this and another, so thank you, but no thank you.
It was a big moment for us to sit down and have a discussion like this in 1990. And what I am, in, you know, here it is 2008 now. And we're still talking.
That's good.
We're still talking.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't going to say anything because I really don't have anything to say on this point, on this particular thing that's on this committee. I was on the committee at one time. Then I retired from the Appeals Commission, and I got back on. So I thought I might add something. We've been discussing something like this for some time. It isn't something that just happened overnight. With the state judges. But my thought is that I think all the tribal judges should come up here and make a comment as to what their feelings are from their particular reservations. We've got 11 reservations in the state of Wisconsin. 6 of them are Chippewa, and then we've got Potawatomi and others like the Oneidas, different reservations. But we have 11 reservations, and I believe we have 10 tribal courts. Oneida is not recognized as a tribal court as such with that term put on there. We're still working on developing a tribal court. And we're having the same kind of discussion that you're having here today. You know, how do we afford the people their constitutional rights under our Constitution, the Oneida Constitution? How do we afford the people their rights under the Wisconsin Constitution? And how far should we go? And should we have jury trials? These are things, and you know, so far what we in our discussion is, if someone asks for it, you have it. What's the big deal? Someone asks for a jury trial, you have it. With us, though, you have a jury of your peers. Unlike in your courts, we don't have a jury of our peers. At least I haven't seen one yet or heard of one. And I think that's a big difference when we can look at our sovereign government and we'll take the decision whatever they decide and we'll stand by it. And in many cases, more often than not, when someone makes a decision to come before us, they want to be heard. They'll accept what the decision is, but they would like to be heard. And I think that's the offer of something that's fair and just, is that opportunity, as you were bringing up earlier. What's fair, and how do you offer that fairness? And what's equal justice? Depends on where you're at. Depends on who you're talking to. Depends on who the parties are. Depends on what the issue is. And then a little bit of it depends on what the law says. What's fair? Because we all have our own definitions of due process. And we all have our own definitions of what fairness is. And what equality is. Depends on where you're at. So that's all I wanted to bring here, is to say that we are looking at these same kinds of things in Oneida. We've been working, at least I have been working with this since 1991, when we started this whole Oneida Appeals Commission, and now we're called the Oneida Tribal Judicial System. But we're still working hard to have this develop. We are working with judges in the state of Wisconsin, so working on these committees, work with the Wisconsin Tribal Judges and the National Judges Association. Go through a lot of training at the National Judicial College. I'm sure some of you have gone there, or maybe all of you have gone there, and some of you are on faculty, you know. So I was put on faculty in the year 2000. So we're all working, I believe we're all working towards the same thing. We're all working towards fairness. We're all working towards equality. And we're working towards recognizing one another with a handshake, if that's possible, to say who we are. In Green Bay, when an individual wants to transfer a case, all they do is, it seems to me, they ask the judge, and the case is transferred to Oneida. There doesn't seem to be a problem there. Allegheny County. So in our, I don't know about the rest of the state, but in our area, we have recognized in that word that I'm beginning to understand more and more, a little bit anyway, is comity. I can even say it correctly now, comity. But it's taken a while. And I would encourage your support for this act, because I think it's time that we continue talking, but it's also time we look into the future for our children so they don't have to come here and be in the same situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Webster. There are two other people who have asked to speak, and I hope they do. I'm going to recognize them, but if we can keep it short so we can conclude this. Huma Hassan, if I've pronounced it correctly, Deputy Director, Great Lakes Indian Law Center, the University of Wisconsin Law School.
Thank you. I just have one comment. I was listening to the comments that were made by all of the tribal judges and the state judges, and I felt compelled to just mention a couple of things. I know Justice Prosser and Justice Rogensack mentioned the issue of if there's a possibility that the constitutional rights of a person would be cut off if this rule were was imposed. I'd like to just to make a quick analogy between what the state currently does and the federal government, and there is a line of cases such as U.S. v. Laura, Duro, that recognize the that tribes and the federal government are two sovereign nations. And currently there are federal regulations such as the Indian Civil Rights Act that requires tribes to provide civil rights to its members. So I think while the federal government has had time to develop a line of cases, Public Law 280 has only been initiated in this state since 1953, and primarily, you know, this is going to be the beginning of probably a line of cases for this court. As I see it, there's probably a couple, all the appeals that could come from this rule would be based on two arguments. Primarily one, tribal courts' legitimacy and probably the tribal courts' capacity. And I think those are probably questions that this court will probably have to answer. I think that's all I wanted to say, just keeping it short. I would like to provide this court with maybe a written comment to some of the problems that were or concerns that were raised by this court, if that would be acceptable.
Why don't you do that, counsel?
Thank you.
Would you add in on the determinations the tribal court capacity to handle the matter? And or does that you think that would come under the court in which the action can be decided most expeditiously? The other, because I think that as to trial court legitimacy, that might be covered in one of the things I'm going to suggest adding, mm-hmm. the differences in procedure of the two courts.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that would probably come under that factor that you just mentioned. I'd just like to mention that I was the former Chief Justice of the Turtle Mountain Court of Appeals, and in North Dakota, from my recollection, off the top of my head, they have used three factors to determine primarily if jurisdiction rests in tribal court or in state court. Now, obviously, Public Law 280 doesn't apply there, but I think the three factors are, one, whether or not the tribe has a tribal court system, two, if the members are enrolled members, and three, if the occurrence of the dispute happened within the tribal boundaries or within the tribal areas.
Yeah, and those are covered here.
Yeah.
To some extent, I don't know if the location, the venue, is covered. That was covered, though, in Teague, and one of the differences. Well, thank you. And when, just for my information and maybe others, when was the Great Lakes Indian Law Center set up, and when did you come?
Okay. The Great Lakes Indian Law Center at the University of Wisconsin Law School was founded in 1992 to assist students, provide students with practical legal experience who are interested in the field of federal Indian law, and to be a legal resource for tribes in the state of Wisconsin. I began
the clinical programs?
Yes.
One of the clinical programs
that
are you classified?
We're still trying to develop. We've had some starts and stops, and, you know, I've kind of come on in the last year through a grant from the Department of Transportation that we're looking at developing tribal Indian businesses through economic development. But we're hoping to move forward. We've applied for several grants. One of them is to study crime rates, specifically on the Indian reservations in the 11 tribes here, and to come up with a technical assistance plan. We see ourselves in the future as providing basically being a legal resource for the tribes, but also working with the tribes to develop infrastructure. And I've come on just in the last year, and so far it's been great.
Well, welcome to Wisconsin, and success in your program, Council.
Thank you.
Council, I have a question. Did you review this proposal at all, looking at our statute at 806.245?
No, I haven't had an opportunity to look at that statute 806.245 yet. But I will include that in my comments.
Good, I'd appreciate that.
And can you give me that statute number one more time?
806.245.
It's the full faith and credit.
That's right. Okay. Full faith and credit in regard to tribal courts in Wisconsin.
Okay, right.
Tied in, obviously, to public law 280.
Right.
Okay.
And the Teague.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to appear on this matter? Since no one has said they wish to appear, I now will close the hearing on 07-11 in the matter of the petition to create a rule governing the discretionary transfer of cases to tribal court. The practice is that we will then go to the next matter, and then after that hearing is concluded, we come back and try and decide these matters. So I'm going to move to 07-12, and we have as our presenter a judge, William McMonagle of Green Lake County Circuit Court, then Mike Nyman, Judge Lina Weber, and Sarah Diedrich of the Wisconsin County Association. Now, is there anyone else here who wants to appear on 07-12? No? Okay. All right. I think we can try and start this. And Judge McMonagle, are you going to take longer than 15 minutes? Mm-hmm. It's a good idea because never get between the court and lunch. All right. We'll start with you.
To address in preparation of this, even though there are three of us joining together in the presentation, we anticipated having a 15 to 20 minute presentation span, so we are condensing our presentations accordingly.
Good, thank you.
One of the advantages of being second is that we learn some things from the first. I found it rather curious that a petition dealing with tribal issues, where many of the Wisconsin Indian Nations are dependent heavily on gaming for their tribal support services, would endure such scrutiny for a petition that was numbered 711.
I thought that was interesting myself.
And they specifically requested that number, I think.
A question that I would anticipate being asked is why our petition was filed in the Supreme Court versus the legislature, because our committee also debated whether this should be a court rule or a matter of legislation. With all due respect, we felt that seven people would be an easier sell than 99 plus one.
Perhaps.
And I would hope that our presentation would be a little bit less intense and a little bit lighter. And with that as a start, once upon a time, a dozen or so years ago, the Supreme Court had a new Chief Justice. She wanted to lead the state courts in new directions. She took charge of PPAC, then a struggling stepchild of the Wisconsin court system, with the aid and assistance of now-retired Judge Gordon Mize. As she presided over one of her early PPAC meetings, she encountered a then much younger, not-so-shy judge from Green Lake County. During the course of that early PPAC meeting, the judge from Green Lake County suggested that PPAC form a subcommittee to look into video conferencing, then an emerging technology with potential applications in the court system. The new Chief Justice looked over at Judge Mize with a puzzled look. The probable caption coming from the Chief would likely have been something like, "Who is this screwball? Video conferencing in the courts? What is he talking about?" To placate the screwball, the Chief agreed to let him have his subcommittee, thinking he would go away soon. The screwball was pleased to learn that within 6 months, the Chief had not only revised her view of video conferencing in the courts, but became a powerful advocate of the technology. PPAC, in partnership with the Wisconsin Counties Association and a statewide committee, published its first work, Bridging the Distance, A Guide to Video Conferencing in the Courts. PPAC and its subcommittee recently completed an updated Bridging the Distance 2005, keeping the publication current with the changes in technology. These are nationally recognized Bibles in the area of video conferencing in the courts. These publications were produced with the assistance of many people from all aspects of video conferencing throughout Wisconsin government. To all of them, PPAC says thank you. I am Judge McMonagle, the screwball in my tail. I am assisted by two of the many capable members of the video conferencing subcommittee, Mike Nyman, a district court administrator from Waukesha County, and Judge Edward Lineweber from Richland County. I will coordinate the presentation. Mr. Nyman hopes to provide the court with some practical information about video conferencing in the courts. Judge Lineweber, the true author of the rule, took the philosophy of the subcommittee and translated the rule for the use of video conferencing in the courts. He will address the rule and its comments. The court has noticed many affected entities or parties or persons who may have interest in the notice for these proceedings. The rule has been endorsed by many who have responded to the court. This list includes, amongst others, the State Bar of Wisconsin, the State Public Defender's Office, the Committee of Chief Judges, the Department of Justice, expressing some anticipated caution about the aggressive or over-aggressive use of video conferencing in the courts, the Wisconsin Counties Association, a longtime partner in video conferencing with the courts, has concerns that are legitimate about the potential for exposing the counties that support the courts with the expenses related to equipment and video conferencing. As I turn the presentation over to my colleagues, I ask the court to keep firmly in mind that this proposed rule is about the use of video conferencing in the courts and, in tandem with Bridging the Distance, completes the 12-year process of bringing video conferencing to the forefront in the state courts of Wisconsin. Nothing in this rule mandates any equipment purchase. It does not invalidate the use of any video conferencing equipment, and above all, places no funding issues at the feet of the county boards. No judge with this rule has any authority except to use what he has or to acquire what he needs through normal budget channels. The rule is proposed solely to codify the current practices, the anecdotal practices, that really constitute the common law of video conferencing into a structure that courts can use with more confidence. It is not a rule containing restrictions, but a rule laying out cautions. It encourages use of video conferencing, but only within procedural and constitutional bounds. The rule has been crafted by a committee of judges, public defenders, district attorneys, attorneys general, and personnel from many other state agencies. The concepts and provisions have been thoroughly vetted, and the proposed rule before you represents that result. As I turn the presentation over to Mr. Nyman, we ask the court to adopt the rule as presented, and we stand ready to address any questions or concerns the court may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge McMonagle, and I'm glad that the screwball to which reference was made was not me.
Worried about that.
I did. I was worried about it. But no longer.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for all your work on video conferencing, which was long and continuous and has been very fruitful for the state of Wisconsin.
We agree.
Thank you. Now, my question is, because we have to stop at about 12, because some of the justices have meetings at 12. Is it better, Mr. Nyman, to hear you and the judge afterwards so that you'd be open to questions? Would that be all right? Because I don't think the two of you are going to finish within 10 minutes when you are also subject to questions. Is that, would you be available? Okay, is that all right with you, Judge?
Fine.
All right, then we're going to recess for lunch.
and the court will return at 1:30. We'll hear from District Court Administrator Mike Nyman, and then from Judge Lineweber, and then from Ms. Deidre. Okay? We are in recess.